Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Opioid addiction and overdose are national public health emergencies. Even if those with opioid addiction disorder don't die from an overdose, there's a good chance they'll contract another life-threatening disease while they're using drugs. Research published in the American Journal of Public Health in December of 2017 found that new hepatitis C cases tripled between 2010 and 2016, most traced to injection drug use among younger adults addicted to opioids. The reasons intravenous drug users share and reuse needles. Needle exchange programs have been around since the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s, and there are currently more than 20 across the state. While few debate the necessity of these programs, some are concerned about crime and safety around needle exchange sites. Today, we discuss syringe service programs and what we know about their effectiveness, what factors should be considered when citing the programs, and what the research tells us about crime and safety around program sites. Joining us on the phone from his office in New Haven is Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. He's also the director of the Emerging Infections Program. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
Also on the phone, Dr. Thomas Topka, assistant professor of public health at Tufts University. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
Dr. Heimer, needle exchanges have been around since the 1980s, but they were not immediately embraced by the public or state and federal government. What were some of the original concerns people had with needle exchanges?
Those concerns actually persist to this day in places where needle exchanges are just starting up. And those concerns are that somehow needle exchanges promote or encourage drug use among individuals who are not currently using drugs, that they produce concentrations of people who are engaged in the illegal activities associated with illicit drug use, and that somehow it sends the wrong message to the rest of the community. I can unequivocally state that all of those concerns are misplaced.
Mm-hmm. So tell us how needle exchanges operate. And, you know, do they have to be brought in order to receive needles? You know, are the needles that are distributed tracked? If so, do we know how many are returned? How does it work?
There are multiple operating modes. When we started ours almost 30 years ago, and there was no effective research on the benefits of needle exchange programs, we did track needles. There's absolutely no point in doing it anymore now that the data, again, unequivocally state that these programs can dramatically reduce HIV transmission and also hepatitis B and C transmission. Whether or not exchange is the mode of syringe distribution or whether people can just simply get as many syringes as they need, we've evaluated those different mechanisms and have found that the distribution model, where you simply ask people how many syringes do they need and give them that many syringes, has the greatest impact with the least negative consequences. Mm. Surprisingly, it turned out that the distribution model resulted in the largest rates of return of program syringes, simply because the syringes were no longer scarce. And the biggest reason why drug users shared syringes in the first place was not because they wanted to share syringes. In all the years I've been talking with drug users, I've only met one person once who said they preferred to inject with the old, dull syringe. Mm. Almost everyone else says, no, they would much prefer a new, clean syringe.
Yeah.
The distribution model gets the the greatest number of such syringes out there for people to use. The U.S. Public Health Service recommends that every injection be made with a new sterile syringe. Now, that's aspirational. That's very hard to achieve when people are injecting three times a day, 365 days a year. That's 1,000 syringes per person per year. That's an enormous volume. But we'd certainly like to approach that number.
Yeah. Dr. Stopka, what do we know about the transmission rates of HIV and hepatitis B and C among drug users? And where are we seeing the highest rates of that in Massachusetts?
Well, hepatitis C is very easily transmitted through used, reused, potentially contaminated syringes. Most research estimates estimate that people are infected with hepatitis C during the first year or two of their injection experience. Because the virus is so virulent, lives outside of the body for long periods of time, and can be so easily transmitted. We've done hotspot cluster analyses in Massachusetts, and we've identified hotspot clusters for hepatitis C prevalence in places like Boston, the greater Boston area, Worcester, Springfield, New Bedford, Fall River. We've also looked at hepatitis C mortality, and those hotspots are similar to the ones I mentioned, but we also see locations in places like North Central Massachusetts and Western Massachusetts and Pittsfield. And we also looked at hepatitis C clustering among young folks under 30 years of age, and we found that over the last decade, there was a shifting in hotspots, and much of the clustering transitioned to the southeastern parts of Massachusetts and the Cape. So including places like Wareham, Plymouth, Bourne, Falmouth, and Hyannis. And so that's particularly concerning. With HIV, there were a couple of decades where we were seeing diminishing transmission of HIV associated with injection drug use, largely due to increased access to sterile syringes at syringe exchange programs and pharmacies. However, in the past few years, we've seen a spike in new HIV diagnoses among people who inject drugs in the Merrimack Valley, so in northeastern Massachusetts, namely in Lowell and in Lawrence.
So what do we know why we see this shifting in the hotspots?
Some folks believe that it is tied to the introduction of fentanyl in the drug supply. Fentanyl is much more potent than heroin, but it has a shorter half-life, so people need to inject more frequently. When they inject more frequently, they're more likely to reuse a syringe, and a syringe that can be contaminated then can be reused and shared, thus increasing risk for transmission of hepatitis C, for instance, and HIV. In the Merrimack Valley, for instance, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health and the CDC, which did an epidemic surveillance study there this past year, feel that fentanyl is largely driving the increased risk for transmission of HIV among injectors, particularly for that reason, shorter half-life, larger number of injections over the course of a day, and a chance for a higher chance of reusing and sharing contaminated syringes.
Is there any correlation with these hotspots and access to needle exchange programs?
Yes. I mean, correlation in that places that have had decreased access or insufficient hours of operation appear to be at higher risk. If we think back to the epidemic outbreak in HIV and hepatitis C in Scott County, Indiana, that happened a few years ago, it was a very rural county where there was no sanctioned syringe exchange program. Pharmacies were not selling syringes over the counter, and so syringe access was greatly limited, and as a result, reuse of syringes was quite high in tight-knit social networks, were really the basis for transmission in those locations. I would say that the Merrimack Valley, namely Lowell and Lawrence, have been in a similar predicament. We've had a mobile syringe exchange in Lowell for a number of years in Lawrence, but only for a couple of hours a week. And so really inadequate access. Even in the past year, where we've received funding to help to support the mobile exchange and establish a brick-and-mortar syringe exchange in Lowell, it's only open 8 hours a week. So the correlation is that when there's decreased access to sterile syringes, there's increased access for disease transmission.
Now, hepatitis B and C, along with HIV, are treatable diseases. What are the long-term health consequences of contracting hepatitis or HIV and AIDS? Do we know the costs associated with treating the diseases during the lifespan of an individual?
I believe Dr. Heimer could most adequately.
Okay. We certainly know hepatitis C is curable. Hepatitis B is vaccine preventable. It is an absolute crime that universal vaccination has not been expanded to the point where people who are at risk because of injection drug use get vaccinated. In our studies, We've routinely seen that 25% to 40% of adults who could well have received the vaccine to prevent hepatitis B infection have not yet been vaccinated. Mm. They come into contact all the time with criminal justice system, with drug treatment programs. There's no reason that these programs, as well as needle exchange programs, can't be providing vaccination coverage to prevent hepatitis B. We've done economic modeling of this and discovered that it's very, very cost-effective to do it because there's a small chance of a very expensive fulminant hepatitis B infection where the liver simply fails, and that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars as compared to the hundreds of dollars that it costs to vaccinate somebody. Mm-hmm. So that's hepatitis B, which is also once it becomes chronic, which doesn't happen all that often, but when it does in about 5% of adults who become infected, it's very, very hard to treat hepatitis B. Hepatitis C is treatable, but the cost of it is very expensive. You can cure someone for maybe $80,000 to $100,000, but that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Preventing, again, is probably cost-effective relative to treating, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't treat people who have already become infected, because if we treat those people and we cure them, then they can't transmit the virus to anybody else. HIV, we have treatment, but we don't have cure. People have to stay on medications for the rest of their lives. Those medications become increasingly less expensive over the course of time. We have more options to prevent people from having their disease progress, but there are still side effects mm-hmm. from HIV medications that do increase the risk of cardiac diseases, liver diseases, and kidney diseases that that put people who are HIV positive and successfully treated for their HIV disease still at higher risk of mortality and morbidity.
Yeah. Under state law, the Mass Department of Public Health must obtain approval from cities or towns before opening syringe service programs. After a 2017 Supreme Judicial Court decision, town approval is not required for privately run programs. And joining us for a better understanding of that case is Christopher Olson, a reporter with Lawyers Weekly. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
So in 2015, the town of Barnstable temporarily shuttered a needle exchange program run by the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, saying it created a nuisance in the area. The group sued the town, and the case ended up at the SJC. So what were the arguments made on both sides of this case?
Sure. Well, I mean, the SJC, as they're often asked to do, was called to interpret statutes, basically, two in this case. And the first was Section 27 of Chapter 94C, and Chapter 94C is the state's Controlled Substances Act. Up until 2006, it was illegal under Section 27 of Chapter 94C to possess, deliver, sell, or exchange hypodermic needles without a prescription. And then in 2006, the legislature decided to amend the statute. They said, you know, we're going to take out those words, possess, deliver, and exchange out of the law. You know, we just want to be in the business of regulating the sale of needles. If you want to buy needles, you have to go to a pharmacist. Otherwise, you know, we're sort of out of this area. And you can sort of see how that would allow a needle exchange program like the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod to exist. They look at the law and they say, we're not selling needles, so this law doesn't apply to us. And, you know, it operates, as I understand it, for a few years without any incident. But then in 2015, there's some improperly disposed needles found, and the town sends a cease and desist. And when they do, they cite to a second law, which is Chapter 11, Section 215, which was what authorized the state's Department of Public Health initially to set up 10 needle exchange programs across the state. They've since removed that limit. So that sort of sets up the arguments that were made to the SJC. And the key part of Chapter 111-215 is that if you run a program through the DPH, you do have to go to the local city or town to get permission to operate. Originally, it was unclear whose permission from the town you needed, but in 2016, they amended it to clarify that it was the local Board of Health. So the town's argument here was, you know, this is, quote unquote, an absurd result, that if they were a DPH program, they'd have had to come to us and ask us for permission. Why should they essentially get off the hook for that requirement just because they're a privately funded organization? And that's essentially the town's argument. And they look at, chapter, they're basically looking at those two statutes together and saying, you know, the state, the legislature is saying, you know, we want there to only be two ways you can get needles, essentially. Go to a pharmacist and buy them, or go to a DPH program. But to make a long story short, the SJC said, no, you know, that's not the way to look at these statutes. And basically, you know, it sort of goes along with I think what the doctors were just describing as a pretty clear public policy of wanting to expand access to needles.
So if towns or residents want to have more say over private needle exchanges, what are their options?
Certainly in certain cases like this where the SJC ruled in a, on a statute, every once in a while, they can go to the legislature and convince the legislature, hey, we think the court got it wrong, and get them to change the law, sort of in reaction to that decision. But, in this case, I think because of that strong public policy to sort of expand access to needles, I don't think that necessarily is going to be something that you'd be able to persuade the legislature to do. I guess the one thing that occurs to me is that because the AIDS Support Group is a private organization that relies on donations, they do sort of have a incentive to be good neighbors. Mm-hmm. So I think this is sort of one of those cases where, rather than trying to pass laws or, use existing laws to sort of as a hammer, it sort of seems like a case where, maybe some, working with the organization and trying to, make the operation of the facility as palatable to the community as possible is sort of the way to go.
Yeah. Christopher Olson, reporter with Lawyers Weekly. Thanks for taking the time to join us. Appreciate your explaining that to us.
All right. Thank you.
Amy, I should add that programs that are funded by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, Massachusetts is very fortunate that the Massachusetts Department of Public Health that can authorize funding for syringe exchange programs. And typically as one step in their funding authorization process, they do require that the agencies that are setting up the syringe exchange hold community meetings mm-hmm. with local stakeholders so that such discussions can take place.
Right. And we should mention the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod is moving forward with a syringe service program in East Falmouth. The Falmouth Department of Public Health has written a letter of support for the program, but some Falmouth residents have expressed concern about the site. The AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, Falmouth Board of Health, and the Massachusetts Department of Public Health all declined our invitation to join our conversation this morning. But we will continue to talk about it after a quick break. And you're listening to The Point. We are talking about syringe service programs this morning, what we know about their effectiveness, what factors should be considered when citing the programs, and what the research tells us about crime and safety around program sites. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the concerns about the East Falmouth site, I know that some folks have expressed, is there is a Boys and Girl Scouts who meet across the street at the Catholic Church. And some, I think they are saying, we're not against syringe programs or needle exchanges, but not in this site because there are these kids meeting across the street. What are your thoughts about that? Either one of you. Dr. Heimer? I mean, what do we know? What do we know about, you know, crime and safety in areas where these needle exchanges are?
The data on this now are you know 20 years old, and studies that were done back in the early days when this was a concern in big cities were able to compare knowledge and attitudes among adolescents who either lived in neighborhoods where needle exchange had started versus individuals who, you know, adolescents who lived in neighborhoods where they weren't, but were also where needle exchange hadn't been established, but also had drug use, you know, situations that were of community concern. And what they found, especially the studies that came out of Baltimore, were that in those sites, yes, the adolescents were aware of the existence of those programs. It did not increase in any way the likelihood that those adolescents would initiate drug use, or that those individual adolescents would become crime victims, or that those individuals would have more negative attitudes toward the people who used drugs. In fact, one of the findings, which I always found interesting, is that by seeing those people who were coming to use the needle exchange program, adolescents were both more sympathetic toward drug users, but also more wary of the dangers of drug use, because they could see that those people were suffering.
Yeah.
And they recognized that kind of suffering was something that they were sympathetic toward, but also didn't want to experience themselves.
Yeah. Now, as you're mentioning, because needle exchanges have been around since the 1980s, they have been studied quite a bit. And you're mentioning the study in Baltimore, and that's Melissa Marks, assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to the program. She's joining us on the phone. Good morning, Dr. Marks.
Thank you for inviting me, Mindy.
Sure. And you evaluated needle exchange programs in Baltimore in the early 2000s, and you looked at the trends in crime and the introduction of needle exchanges back in the 1990s. Tell us a little bit more about your research and findings.
Sure. First, I want to appreciate that you're providing a forum for discussing these issues. They've been controversial, and constructive dialogue can help. In fact, it was the same kind of controversy that back in the mid-1990s prompted the studies you asked me about. There was local concern about increases in drug use, crime, discarded needles, and about, as your panelist just said, sending a message that was mixed to kids about drug use. So we undertook a series of studies to explore these concerns in Baltimore. So as far as the crime analysis, we compared the change in the number of drug use-related arrests in areas close to the needle exchange programs versus half a mile away or more in the 6 months versus the 14 months after, 6 months before versus 14 months after introduction of the program. And briefly, while there was an increase in the number of arrests overall in the city over this period, the increase was not higher in the needle exchange program areas versus the non-needle exchange program areas. In fact, arrests decreased in both areas for drug paraphernalia, including needles and syringes, which I know is a key concern. Mm-hmm. We looked and found no differences in the number of arrests for possession, break-ins, resisting arrest, or violent offenses over the study period. So similar to some other studies that have been done on crime, there was no association between introduction of this needle exchange program and crime in Baltimore at that time.
Mm. I think Dr. Heimer touched on this, but Dr. Marks, you also published research on adolescent attitudes toward needle exchange programs. Tell us why you looked into this and then what you found.
Sure. Well, this was one of the concerns that was being voiced in the public, and we felt it was important to address it. So we conducted a study of 9th and 10th graders in four Baltimore City schools to see whether they thought needle exchange programs and other key influencing factors made them want to use drugs. So briefly, only 11% said needle exchange programs influenced them to want to use drugs, compared to 50% who said the same thing about parents using drugs, and 7% who said the same thing about anti-drug campaigns that they had during school influencing them to want to have drugs. And nearly half of the participants said that needle exchange programs deter them from wanting to use drugs, slightly less than the 57% who said that anti-drug messages at school deterred them, and much less than the 28% who said that parents using drugs deterred them. So these were kids directly affected by drug use and the HIV epidemic at the time. Nearly half reported knowing someone who was HIV positive. So the bottom line from that study was that needle exchange programs were not a promoter of drug use among kids.
Mm. Dr. Melissa Marks, Assistant Professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks for taking time to talk with us today. Appreciate your input.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
866-999-4626 is our number if you have a question about these programs. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Again, with us this morning, Dr. Robert Heimer, Professor of Epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, also Director of the Emerging Infections Program, and Dr. Thomas Stopka, Assistant Professor of Public Health at Tufts University. Dr. Stopka, your dissertation looked at crime rates and a pharmacy-run needle exchange program. Tell us about that research and findings.
So we published a study in 2014 that focused on crime in police reporting districts in the city of L.A. And we compared police reporting districts where pharmacies had registered to sell syringes over the counter, so without a prescription, to police reporting districts where pharmacies did not opt to sell syringes over the counter. And we looked at crime outcomes within those areas. We looked at overall crime rates. We looked at economically motivated crime, nuisance crime, violent crime, and other crime rates. And we actually found that crime decreased over time. We looked at a 3-year time span, 6-month periods. We looked at crime rates before pharmacies started to sell syringes over the counter, and after. And we found that in both the police reporting districts where pharmacies were selling syringes and those that were not, crime decreased steadily over time. Now, we can't say that that's attributed to the sale of syringes. It's likely a secular trend. But from a public health and public safety perspective, it was very reassuring to see that crime rates were not increasing in police districts where pharmacies were selling syringes. We did see that crime rates were associated with the typical suspects, that crime rates were associated with socio-demographic variables, including income and poverty. But we actually saw a negative association between pharmacy syringe sales and crime within Los Angeles. So that was, again, very reassuring from a public health and public safety perspective.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, we do find discarded needles all over these days at the beach and parking lots. I even think we've seen some in some of the school playgrounds. And I think Dr. Marks talked about the evidence she found in Baltimore. But do we know, is there evidence that there are more discarded needles around needle exchange sites? Less, do we know?
We did a study comparing New Haven and Hartford, which had needle exchange programs at the end of the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s, to Springfield, which did not. And we found far more discarded syringes in Springfield than we could find in neighborhoods that were known for high rates of injection drug use in New Haven or Hartford. And surprisingly, when we found needles in Hartford and tested them for their contents, we were far more likely to find that they contained insulin, meaning that these were needles being discarded by people who were diabetics, not drug users.
That's interesting.
So one cannot always attribute a discarded needle to a drug user. Diabetics, because of prescribing by their physicians and because of insurance of some kind, often have much greater access to the large numbers of syringes and therefore can be much more cavalier about how they discard them. Whereas for drug users, syringes for many of them still remain scarce supplies and they tend not to discard them as readily, and certainly to take care of them. We have, and we can see this in both the statistics about syringe discards collected from places where there are needle exchanges versus no needle exchanges, where all of a sudden, like the situation with the bottle deposits on soda, you have now an exchange value for your syringe, right?
Yeah.
Not worth 5 cents, but it's worth something. It's worth syringes. When you go back to the exchange and you drop off a bunch of syringes, you can pick up a bunch of syringes.
Yeah. When you did the testing of did you also test these for if they carried, I don't know if you can do this, carried hepatitis B or C or HIV?
We have done extensive testing on issues like that, including how long the viruses can stay alive in different kinds of syringes. We certainly can recover evidence of use by people who are infected with hepatitis C or with HIV or with hepatitis B, and we've used that information to demonstrate how quickly and how effectively an expanding syringe exchange program can drive down the risks for the entire population by decreasing the percentage of contaminated. We've also determined that the rate of exchange of syringes, the faster syringes are turned over, the more quickly the risks from sharing syringes and getting infected goes down.
Mm.
The one area where we have not been able to have a sufficiently large impact on HIV and hepatitis transmission is that what we forget is that for many people, drug use is a social activity. They're doing it with other people. And that when they share drugs, there are also risks. Even if people have their own syringes, the process of dissolving and sharing drugs can put people at risk, even if they have their own syringes.
Mm.
If Tom and I, for instance, were to go and share drugs, and I used my dirty syringe and used it to dissolve drug and handed him half of the drug, he would get what was in my syringe, even if he had his own syringe.
Wow.
We haven't at needle exchange programs and harm reduction programs in general, stress that message importantly enough that if you're going to share drugs with other people, the drug should be made up and shared using clean syringes only.
Yeah.
Another reason why syringe exchanges are important is that it gives people greater access to the number of clean syringes they need to meet that disease prevention activity.
Mm. You mentioned that you studied how long it can remain in the needle. I imagine that's different for hepatitis and HIV. What is that? What's the answer to that?
Well, it depends on syringe type. It depends on temperature.
Mm.
Both HIV and hepatitis C survive longer when it's cold and a shorter period of time when it's hot. So people, if you want to think about it, may be more at risk of disease transmission in the winter than in the summer.
Hmm.
But let's just look at room temperature and the type of syringes that individuals most commonly inject with in the United States, which are insulin syringes with attached needles. The volume that's retained in those needles when the plunger is fully depressed is very, very small, on the order of 2 to 3 millionths of a liter. That's like less. That's such a small drop that you can't even really see it.
Hmm.
Inside those needles, HIV can survive for up to about 3 weeks.
Wow!
Although the rate of syringes that would contain transmissible virus does go down fairly rapidly, probably stays stable for 5 to 7 days, then goes down to zero after about 3 weeks. Hepatitis C actually decays more quickly inside those syringes and goes down to zero within about 10 days.
Hmm. So what is the health risk to someone who's stuck with one of these discarded needles? I mean, that's everybody's big concern. You're going to pick it up, you know, a kid's going to pick it up and they're going to prick their finger. You know, what's the risk?
For a discarded needle on the street, the risk is nil, because unless someone decides to make believe they were injecting drugs and load it with liquid and then inject it into themselves. If they're just pricked with it, the virus doesn't survive for very long on the outside of the needle itself. It's inside the barrel of the syringe or inside the bore of the needle. So the risk for a needle stick like that is small. The risk for a probably more substantial risk is for tetanus.
866-999-4626 is our number. Hopefully we're answering some of your questions about needle exchange programs. If you have some, give us a call, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about syringe service programs, also called needle exchanges, what we know about their effectiveness, what factors should be considered when citing the programs, and what the research tells us about crime and safety around program sites. If you have questions, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and also director of the Emerging Infections Program, and also Dr. Thomas Stopka, assistant professor of public health at Tufts University. Federal and state funding now available for needle exchanges, or what we call syringe service programs. So talk about the wraparound services many of these locations offer. They offer other things other than just needles.
Sure, Mindy. And I think you mentioned the terminology which is key and which is used more regularly today, and that is rather than calling them syringe exchange programs or needle exchange programs, we do call them syringe service programs. And that's precisely because they provide wraparound services, which include HIV, hepatitis C testing. Some sites also provide sexually transmitted disease testing. They provide referrals to drug treatment programs, including detox programs, including medication for assisted therapy programs like buprenorphine, methadone maintenance programs. And some also provide clinical services on site, abscess wound care services, for instance, that a nurse or nurse practitioner or physician can provide. And so there's a whole range of services, even beyond the syringe exchange, that allows people to receive access to clinical care and public health care that they otherwise might not receive.
Yeah. Is there evidence that the syringe service programs are a pathway to treatment for those with addiction disorder?
They can be, and it depends whether or not there's somebody at those programs who is charged with making those linkages to care. When the New Haven program in its early days had someone who was responsible for making referrals and getting people to those referral sites, we found that if people had to wait, you know, one day or two, 80% of the people would enter treatment. If they had to wait 5 days or a week, 50% of the people made the treatment. If they had to wait more than that, the likelihood of getting into treatment went down to 20%. So if there's a service if there are enough resources for the syringe for the access programs to be able to actually help people make the transition, not just provide a written referral, yes, you can find that these programs are a conduit to getting people into treatment. The difficulty is getting people into the right kind of treatment. Yeah. And for opiate use disorder, abstinence-based programs have remarkably high failure rates of 90% or more at 6 months. Putting people into such programs may actually even put people at greater risk of dying than if they just continued using drugs on the street, because when they fail in those programs, they come out, they're no longer as tolerant to their opioids. They take the same amount of opioids they used to take, and now they're going to experience an overdose.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that in data from Connecticut, that actually people who've been in an abstinence-based program last year are at a higher risk of opioid overdose deaths than the people who are continuing to use drugs on the street, as dangerous as that latter thing is.
Yeah. You know, this brings up a good question. You know, we hear a lot about, you know, the methadone treatment, Suboxone, Vivitrol. How is that determination made of which method is you know, most beneficial?
The problem is we do not have reasonably good follow-up data on abstinence-based programs because they're not obliged to do this. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we don't really, unless people go out and collect very large databases of data and analyze them, it's very hard to determine whether or not to compare across programs and across platforms. Mm-hmm. But we do know that if you retain longer in a treatment program and if you remain and if you're not using illicit drugs, then your likelihood of remaining disease-free and your likelihood of not having a fatal or non-fatal overdose, the chances are better that you'll remain healthy. Mm-hmm. And since retention in agonist-based programs, methadone and buprenorphine, Suboxone, are so much higher than retention in abstinence-based programs, a very superficial analysis reveals that these programs have much greater benefit for maintaining people's health. Even substitution programs where you replace illicit heroin use with legal access to heroin has been done in Switzerland and Germany and the Netherlands and Canada and Spain. Analysis of those programs reveal that people who, even if they're using heroin, if it's being done in a medically supervised way, they end up being healthier. Mm-hmm. At the end of the Dutch heroin trial, one of the conclusions was that the health of the drug users was indistinguishable from that of the general Dutch public, which is remarkable because when we think of heroin users in general, we think of them as experiencing ill health.
Yeah. Oh, we have an email from Meredith in Martha's Vineyard. Says, I live in Martha's Vineyard. We have instituted an exchange program, but the biggest problem is trust. Most people won't go to the exchange for fear of being known. A more effective approach would be injection sites. Wraparound services are offered, but the dearth of effective programs here is a problem. Additional protocols have been added to access and by the public provider that makes access extremely difficult. Thoughts on that?
I think in general, places, less urban communities find instituting fixed site or even mobile, van kind of based needle exchange programs difficult because people don't want to be known to the community. They want to retain their anonymity. For such situations, reasonable alternatives that have been shown to work in other places include home delivery. Hmm. In someone drives up in a Subaru, and rings the doorbell and hands people a package, or ordering by mail.
Hmm. Yeah. So, what factors should be considered when citing needle exchanges? Should they be dispersed throughout the community, located closer to health or medical service areas? What are your thoughts? Do we have some research on that?
We try, in some of the recent work that we've done in Lowell, for instance, which is experiencing the spike in HIV cases among drug injectors, we've begun to do a vulnerability analysis. And so we overlay in some of our maps overdose rates, hepatitis C infection locations, and HIV rates. And we're able to get a feel for where there are higher vulnerabilities in the city and lower vulnerabilities. We also look at other health outcomes and risk factors. And the more locations where one can set up, the better, but particularly when they're in high-risk locations and locations that are generally more traversed by people who use drugs.
Now, some have expressed annoyance that the Falmouth Board of Health wrote a letter of support for the needle exchange in East Falmouth because it could enable the AIDS support group to apply for funding from the Mass Department of Public Health. The thought being, if they couldn't get state funding, maybe they'd find a new location. I'm not sure about the validity of this rationale, but it suggests that the general public hasn't been well informed about the outcomes associated with these syringe service support programs. So what are your thoughts on getting community buy-in on these programs? We seem to have the same concerns and controversies we've had since this started in the 1980s.
I think one thing that has changed in recent years is the overdose epidemic. And that's another thing that syringe service programs can provide is naloxone, which is the antidote to reverse mm-hmm. opioid overdoses. And I think that the most recent spike in overdose cases over the last 10 years has shown us that it's not an us and them thing, that we've seen increasing overdose rates in urban, suburban, rural communities. And so I would hope that we could take this lesson that, you know, drug use is not an us and them thing, that overdose is not an us and them thing, that HIV and hepatitis C really permeates our communities, and that public health programs that are well situated in high-risk locations could be the most effective in decreasing risk, not only for drug users, but for the larger community. I do think that public forums, mm-hmm. such as community meetings, could be helpful in presenting this information. The fact that you're doing this radio program, I think, is another huge step mm-hmm. in trying to promote and to explain the benefits of syringe service programs.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Heimer?
Yeah, I also think that normalizing syringe exchange as a community activity has merit. One of my favorite stories is that in Nashville, there was no public health-based program. The needle exchange program was run by the minister at the Metropolitan Baptist Church, and what he would have his congregants do, since it was an entirely volunteer-type program, was he had the old church ladies sit around in the in the church and help prepare the packages of supplies for people, and by normalizing this activity as something that was socially productive, he got great community buy-in, and for many years we've sort of one of the things we experienced here in New Haven at the beginning of our needle experience with needle exchange was that the African American community was more resistant. We felt it was being imposed upon them by the work that was done at the Metropolitan Baptist Church, which is a predominantly African American congregation, was to make this an acceptable thing for the community to be doing.
Yeah. The Falmouth Board of Health will have a meeting for the public about the needle exchange on Saturday, January 12th, 9 a.m. at the Falmouth High School. Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and director of the Emerging Infections Program, and Dr. Thomas Stopka, assistant professor of public health at Tufts University. Thank you both so much for coming on and explaining all of this to us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share what we've learned over the last almost 30 years of research.
Yeah, thank you, Mindy, for the opportunity, and thanks for shining light on this important public health and public safety issue.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.